This week on The Inside Story, Ukraine, Russia, and a possible path to peace, tariffs, trade wars, and turmoil in the stock market, plus new technology powered by plants. That's now on The Inside Story.
Welcome to The Inside Story. I'm Katherine Gibson in Washington. Talks between the United States, Ukraine, and Russia to end the war in Ukraine are continuing, and there are some signs of progress. The Trump administration and Ukrainian leader Zelensky have agreed to a 30-day ceasefire, and U.S. officials say they soon will be heading to Moscow. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias has the details.
In Saudi Arabia, Ukrainian negotiators accepted a proposal by a U.S. delegation to pause the Russia-Ukraine war for 30 days.
We made an offer that the Ukrainians have accepted, which is to enter into a ceasefire and into immediate negotiations to end this conflict in a way that's enduring and sustainable. And it counts for their interests, their security, their ability to prosper as a nation.
U.S. President Donald Trump rewarded Ukraine's positive first step toward peace, said U.S. National Security Advisor Mike Waltz.
The president has decided to lift the pause on aid and on our security assistance to Ukraine going forward. And that's effective immediately.
After really embracing the truce proposal, the Ukrainian delegation reiterated its commitment to peace.
And for the people in the world, it's necessary once again to understand, not Ukraine started this war, but Ukraine ready for just and lasting peace.
Earlier Tuesday, Ukraine launched a massive drone attack against several Russian regions. Moscow said the attack could hinder future peace negotiations.
There are no negotiations yet, so there is nothing to disrupt yet, although the emerging trends can indeed be significantly damaged.
Despite the tensions on the ground, it is expected the United States will move forward with its plans to present the ceasefire proposal to Russia next, in the hope that it will kickstart the process to achieving a lasting peace agreement. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News.
Many Muscovites are trying to ignore the war, but many also hope that negotiations between the Kremlin and the new U.S. administration will soon bring a peace that Russians consider a victory. Officials say the goal is international recognition of the new borders that the Russian army has obtained by force.
It is clear that there will be a bilateral settlement between us and Kyiv. It should be a peace treaty that will legalize the new borders of Russia and the post-Soviet borders of Ukraine.
Many in Moscow are already celebrating the new geopolitical scenario before the conflict has ended.
This is a real victory. You can open champagne. Also, it cannot be lost. Russia must continue the offensive because no one canceled the ambitions of the United States. Yes, they are afraid of us, but it does not mean that they abandoned their idea of a world empire.
After more than 3 years of war, independent media outlet Mediazona counts more than 95,000 Russian casualties. But these losses are not stopping the Kremlin from carrying on with the war. In a meeting with wives and mothers of deceased soldiers, Russian President Vladimir Putin said there would be no concessions.
We are not going to do that. We must choose for ourselves a version of the world that would suit us and that would ensure peace for our country for a long historical perspective.
Critics of Putin can only speak from exile. As they see it, the Kremlin could make concessions, but giving up its territorial ambitions is out of the question.
Compromises can be presented on some other issues related to how the Ukrainian security architecture will be formed after the war. Moscow wants to be a participant in the formation of this new Ukrainian security architecture and, in fact, to describe what can be done and what cannot be done.
Russian officials are looking forward to a meeting with U.S. officials following the talks between U.S. and Ukrainian negotiating teams in Saudi Arabia. So far, there is no such gathering in sight.
In Israel, hardliners welcome President Trump's vision for a future Gaza. The plan calls for many of the enclave's 2.3 million Palestinians to leave, and that would pave the way to developing the Gaza waterfront. Supporters say that encouraging Palestinians to leave does not violate international law. Palestinians and more than a dozen neighboring Arab nations disagree and are rejecting the idea. From Jerusalem, Linda Gradstein has this report.
The far-right Land of Israel caucus and the Knesset met Sunday in a special session to endorse U.S. President Donald Trump's plan for relocating 2.3 million Palestinians out of Gaza. Israeli Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich says he is establishing a migration authority within the defense ministry to encourage Palestinians to leave Gaza.
Every shekel we will invest in encouraging migration will cost us less than fighting again and again. The budget will not be an obstacle to this plan. This is not just another plan. It is a potential for historic change in the Middle East and Israel.
Knesset member Simcha Rothman says this relocation plan is more realistic than the one recently proposed by Egypt and the Arab League, which would allow the Palestinian Authority to run Gaza without disarming the U.S.-designated terrorist group Hamas.
People will say, let's rehabilitate Hamas. Let's give Hamas all the opportunity to rebuild its forces. How come this is a realistic solution? It's not. It's dangerous to Gaza, it's dangerous to Gazans, and it's dangerous to the peace of this area.
Far-right legal scholars at the Land of Israel caucus meeting say that encouraging emigration from a war zone is not a violation of international law.
We know that in time of war, there are refugees. From Afghanistan, millions of refugees. From the war in Syria, millions of refugees. From the war in Ukraine, millions of refugees. None of this is called ethnic cleansing. Now, the creation of such refugees cannot be done on purpose, but it need not be specifically prevented as a consequence of war.
Representatives of Israeli liberal organizations disagree.
This is not voluntary removal of people. It's displacement or transfer of population. It's a war crime and it's immoral. If you make people's life miserable and then you say they want to leave the place, it's not that they voluntarily go out.
Many at the Knesset caucus called for Israel to reestablish the 21 Jewish settlements in the Gaza Strip, which were evacuated in 2005 when Israel unilaterally withdrew from the territory.
The people of Israel are ready to fight, are ready to carry out President Trump's idea of immigration of the Gazans. At the same time, the people of Israel are ready and willing to fulfill the goal of Zionism to settle the entire Gaza with Jewish settlers.
While the prospect of rebuilding Jewish settlements in Gaza seems unlikely, most Israelis agree that Hamas should have no role in its future. And some believe the best way to ensure that is to get most Palestinians to leave Gaza. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Syrian leaders say they're concerned by Turkey's military and diplomatic influence in their country. There's been a power vacuum in Syria since the fall of former President Bashar al-Assad's regime. Dorian Jones has this story.
Turkish and Israeli leaders are battling over the future of Syria. Analysts say Israel is increasingly concerned over Syria's new regime and Turkey's growing influence over its leadership.
The view is that not very optimistic about the future of Syria in terms of that it will become a potential threat to Israel, and that in this potential threat, the fact that Turkey will be dominant is also dangerous to Israel.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's strong support of U.S.-designated terror group Hamas has strained relations with Israel. Now, Syria is threatening to become a new source of tension. In a speech this month, Erdogan gave a widely interpreted, thinly veiled warning to Israel to stop undermining Damascus's new rulers.
Those who hope to benefit from the instability of Syria by provoking ethnic and religious affiliations in the country should know that they will not achieve their goals.
Erdogan's speech followed Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's offer to support Syria's Druze and Kurdish minorities. Analysts say Ankara and Jerusalem have conflicting visions over the future of Syria.
Turkey wants to see a secure and stabilized unitary state under al-Sharaa's transitional government. Israel, on the other hand, wants to see a weak and fragmented Syria. Israel's main concern has always been securing its northern border.
Israeli forces are occupying Syrian territory along its northern border, which is home to many of Syria's Druze minority. But on Monday, Kurdish-led forces of the SDF signed an agreement to integrate its administration and military with Syria's transitional government. The SDF controls a large swath of Syria. With Damascus tightening its control, analysts say Israel will be concerned over Turkey expanding its military presence inside Syria.
Especially if Turkey wishes to have military posts in the south of the country, I suppose with the permission of the government in Damascus, then the two sides would be very close with military forces, and that, I think, is a fairly dangerous or volatile incendiary situation.
Analysts warn such a military presence, if extended to air bases, could threaten Israel's current unchallenged access to Syrian airspace. With Erdogan and Netanyahu making little secret of their dislike and distrust, that rivalry, analysts warn, threatens to extend to Syria, further complicating the country's transition from the Assad regime. Doreen Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Officers from the Department of Homeland Security this weekend arrested a Palestinian graduate student in New York, alleging that he led activities aligned with Hamas. The student, Mahmoud Khalil, did play a role in organizing protests about the war in Gaza at Columbia University. He is also married to an American citizen and holds a permanent residency green card. VOA's Aaron Renan has this update from New York.
At Columbia University, the detention and possible deportation of alumnus and activist Mahmoud Khalil has ignited debate. The Department of Homeland Security confirmed his arrest on Saturday, accusing Khalil of leading activities aligned with Hamas, a designated terrorist organization. The Trump administration defends the move, stating it is enforced under an executive order prohibiting anti-Semitism and is necessary to protect Jewish students and ensure campus safety. Reactions on campus are mixed.
I'm actually a foreign student from Israel, but it was a worry of mine when I came to Columbia of how I'd be treated as an Israeli student and as a Jewish student as well. I think that this is a first step that the government is taking in order to tell Columbia, basically, this needs to stop.
Yeah, I just think that it creates a lot of uncertainty for the university and a kind of a chilling effect. So on one hand, people are worried about what they write in emails, what they're studying. Even the discussions that are happening in classrooms, people are thinking twice about what they say.
Supporters argue that the Trump administration's actions are a critical step in addressing rising concerns about anti-Semitism and ensuring the safety of all students.
I certainly applaud these actions by the Trump administration, and I'm grateful for them. After more than a year of ongoing harassment and violence on college campuses and in city streets, finally, the administration is coming up, upholding the law and making it very clear that foreign nationals who support terrorism and espouse terrorist activity have no place in the United States of America.
Someone cannot be summarily arrested and imprisoned.
However, not all agree. Recent protests at Columbia reflected growing concern that the administration's tactics might infringe on fundamental rights and freedoms.
I think that the silencing of voices of protest of the Gaza war and of Israel's policies in the name of preserving Jewish safety is is profoundly wrong and misdirected and is used as a vehicle for actually suppressing our speech more broadly.
Our message to the Trump administration is that we will not be silenced. The First Amendment is still alive and well in the United States of America. Green card holders, like other residents of the United States, have a right to free speech. They cannot be arrested and detained and deported for expressing views that the president disagrees with.
Meanwhile, some political leaders strongly support the administration's decisive stance on campus safety.
If you are on a student visa and you're in America, and you're an aspiring young terrorist who wants to prey upon your Jewish classmates, you're going home. And I think the American people understand that, they're supporting it, and I'm glad we have a president who's strong enough to lay down the law.
As legal appeals continue, the outcome of this case could set a precedent for how universities and the government balance campus safety with the protection of free speech and academic freedom. Aaron Rainin, VOA News, New York City.
President Donald Trump has been very clear that his administration will use tariffs as a tool to fix what he calls an imbalance in trade. Since taking office, he's imposed or threatened to impose tariffs on America's top trading partners, Canada, China, and Mexico. But talk of tariffs, combined with fears of inflation, has led to some turmoil in the stock market. VOA's White House correspondent Carolyn Pursuti looks at what the future may hold.
Day two, another plunge of the U.S. stock market. President Donald Trump escalating an already tense trade war. The president threatening to double tariffs on Canadian metals after Canada's intent to raise the price of electricity exports to the U.S. At the end of the day, both men backing down, leaving stocks shaken. The president still plans the original 25% tariffs on Canada to promote products made in America.
The right thing to do is what we're doing. We're going to get our jobs back, and we're not going to be left at.
For the past 36 years, Ramon Pereyes has managed Taberna del Alabadero. His business lived through COVID and the tariffs of President Trump's first term.
I remember 2018, 2020. It's going to be all right. Politician
is a game, right? The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped nearly 900 points Monday and nearly 500 Tuesday. Losses felt in Roger Frechette's retirement account.
It's really tough to see all that value disappearing so quickly. I think much of what has been gained the entire year is now probably gone.
People are jumping to conclusions, and it's a little overreacting right now. So we'll see. Give it like 30 days to see what the effects of these tariffs and everything. Because even President Trump keeps changing his mind. So who knows?
Financial analysts say it's that unpredictability that stings.
It's hard for investors and for businesses and for American consumers to sort of know what the future policy environment looks like. Getting more certainty there, I think, would be helpful to people.
When asked if he predicts a recession, President Trump said, "I don't see it at all." Many, though, are looking to the stock market to answer that question. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News, the White House.
The Chagos Islands are one of the last traces of the British Empire. They're also home to a key U.S. military base. But under pressure from the United Nations, Britain appears set to transfer sovereignty of the islands back to their historical affiliation with Mauritius. Critics say the deal would compromise the security of the region amid a growing threat from China. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
The Chagos Islands, about 2,500 kilometers east of Madagascar, have been a British colony since 1814. They've been administered from Mauritius, which argues it was illegally forced to give them away in return for its own independence in 1968. Britain forcibly expelled the Chagos Islands population in the 1960s and 70s to make way for a US military base on Diego Garcia, one of the largest islands in the archipelago. In 2019, the International Court of Justice said Britain should cede control of the islands to Mauritius. Now, London is seeking to finalise such a deal. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer told lawmakers last month it was vital to secure the future of the US base.
Without legal certainty, the base cannot operate in practical terms as it should. That is bad for our national security, and it's a gift to our adversaries.
It's reported that Britain will cede sovereignty of the Chagos Islands and pay Mauritius around $116 million a year for 99 years to lease back Diego Garcia and allow the military base to remain. US President Donald Trump said last month that he was inclined to approve the deal. It also has the backing of India, which has close ties to Mauritius. But there are security concerns. Britain's Conservative opposition party has described the proposed plan as a strategic disaster for Britain. China has a burgeoning economic relationship with Mauritius. Some fear those ties could compromise the US base on Diego Garcia. Evan Fowler is from the Interparliamentary Alliance on China, which focuses on threats from Beijing.
Mauritius owes China quite a lot. It uses that to seek sort of political advantage. That area is strategically important to us, and the Chinese understand this too. The Chinese have already been active militarily around the Chagos Islands.
After their expulsion, many Chagossians settled in Mauritius. Thousands also left for Britain. Frankie Bontom and Maxwell Evanor are with the advocacy group Chagossian Voices. They argue Mauritius has never had a rightful claim to their homeland and object to Britain's proposed deal to cede sovereignty.
Once again, we are ignored. People are discussing the future of our homeland without us. We feel like history repeating itself.
We now find ourselves, our very own identity, our very own self, being given to someone else by maid of policy without asking us. We are still colonized. We are the lost colony of Africa.
Under the terms of the deal, Chagossians and their families would be able to return to the outer islands in the archipelago, but not to Diego Garcia, which would remain off limits. The Chagossians are eager to return home, but they appear powerless as geopolitical forces shape negotiations over the future of the islands. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
An innovative solution to remotely powered devices using natural biological processes could help farmers get the most from their fields. VOA's Kane Fairbaugh has more.
One of the biggest challenges for Mount Pulaski, Illinois farmer Tom Martin is understanding the quality of the soil in the fields where his corn and soybeans grow.
It's one of the basics of our profitability. Be able to know what's in our soils to be able to grow our crops. Testing in the past has been unreliable.
That information influences how much fertilizer Martin might need to buy. But using technology to gather data deep in the middle of his fields, far away from sources of electricity and underneath growing crops blocking the sun's solar energy, Martin's biggest obstacle in analyzing the soil is powering devices that gather information. Laura Jaliff is a postgraduate research student at Northwestern University. She's been working on a device that doesn't need a battery and works almost anywhere in any condition, day or night.
It's meant to address the challenge of soil health sensing in agriculture.
The microbial fuel cell Jaliff works with is the creation of Northwestern University student Bill Yen.
So all we're doing is we're putting a device there that can grab all these electrons that these microbes release, and then we're using that to channel into our electronic devices to create our source of power.
Researchers first discovered microbes could naturally produce electricity as early as 1911. But only recent advances, like the soil sensors Yen and Jaliff developed, are beginning to show the technology is viable.
All it is an anode and a cathode. So we have two pieces of electrode that we made out of carbon felt. So these can be things that you can make from really plant matter. So you can make carbon felt anywhere in the world just by processing biomass.
Harnessing the natural power of microbes doesn't produce enough electricity to power cell phones or personal devices. It only creates about 200 microwatts of energy. With the information the microbial fuel cell can provide, Martin isn't just helping his finances by reducing fertilizer use. He's also helping the environment. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Mount Pulaski, Illinois.
That's all for this week's edition of The Inside Story. Thanks for watching.